You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, it's been an interesting week. I mean, today is Monday, but it's been an interesting weekend. This new story out about the DEA and how they're spying on us and then handing that information off to police agencies to reinvent the spying to deny that the DEA was all behind it tells me why the government is fighting so hard to keep pot laws in place, frankly. We'll get into that a little later on in the program. Over the weekend, the piece I did a long rant about on Friday here on this program about the BBC reporting that in a longitudinal study from 1908 until 1998 in both Australia and the UK, whenever conservative governments were in power, suicide rates went up, and whenever liberal governments were in power, suicide rates went down. That got posted over on the, it was on Alternet and Truth Out over the weekend. It got posted over to The Blaze, and so I got this, Glenn Beck's site, the one that often cross-posts with Stormfront, the white supremacy site. So I got all these emails calling me an N-word lover and death threats. And the normal stuff that happens when my name pops up on The Blaze. And one guy, Noel Shepard, over at Newsbusters, wrote an article saying, "Is there anything a liberal won't blame conservatives for?" And he went off on a screed on me. We invited Noel to come on the program today. I'd love to hear his take on this, but he was apparently too afraid to even call my producer back. He had one of his interns call my producer and say, "No, sorry, Noel's afraid to come on the program." Or words to that effect. But speaking of Noel's, Noel Flasterstein is with us, who is not afraid to come on my program. He's done it many times in the past. He's a gun rights advocate, attorney, general counsel for the Second Amendment Club of America, a Florida carry consulting attorney. If you're in Florida and you want help getting a permit to carry a concealed weapon, he's your guy. FloridaCarry.org is his website, along with GunRightsForYou.com. Noel, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Noel, I saw this is, we passed this story along to you, and I wanted to get your take on it. Washington State, not Washington, D.C., but the state of Washington on the West Coast, State Representative Matt Shea, Republican, Tea Party Republican, at a recent Tea Party rally said, and I quote, "We need to prepare for the inevitable collapse that's going to happen. You know it's going to happen. That's right. I am a politician, and I'm standing up here and saying when it happens, we need to look at this as an opportunity, not a crisis. Whose job is liberty? That's our job." And then he went on to suggest that people, in order to prepare for their job, should be stockpiling ammo, practicing shooting, and learning defensive tactics. What percentage of the gun-owning public in America do you think subscribes to this kind of theology or perspective or belief or whatever you want to call it, Noel?
I really couldn't give you the exact figures. I wouldn't even know where to base my analysis. But I will say this. I would say maybe 10 years ago, statements like this from Mr. Shea, am I saying
sure.
it right?
Yeah, S-H-E-A, I'm assuming it's Shea. I don't actually know. So.
I assume he's a good old Irish fella.
Yeah.
You would dismiss it. And when I first, heard about his comments and statements, my first inclination is to dismiss it. But I like to think of myself as a rational and reasonable person, and I know there are many of your listeners that would disagree with that comment or that self-evaluation. And I will say this. When he makes statements like he does or like he did, I no longer dismiss it simply as conspiracy theory, and I would say most gun-owning Americans likewise are starting to take what we once thought was crazy 10 years ago would not be considered crazy today. And I had a good friend once share me some ideas that 10 years ago would definitely be considered radical, and he even told me, "Noel, if I told you this 10 years ago, I would tell you you should have me locked up." But there are more and more people in the American public that I think are starting to take a look at what's going around. I mean, he made some outlandish comments, but you know.
But Noel, this was
ammunition. You can't.
This was Tim McVeigh's shtick. This was David Koresh's shtick. That, you know, we have FEMA camps. This guy has said there are FEMA camps that are just waiting for you. Which presumably goes back through several administrations, is apparently a bipartisan conspiracy by our federal government. He proposed a bill to ban the U.S. dollar. This is spooky stuff. And when people get frightened that economic bad times are coming, and frankly, I believe economic bad times are coming. I think that, the crash of 2008, we only got halfway into it. And then they kind of wallpapered over the giant holes in the system, and it's going to come back and haunt us. But that doesn't mean that I'm loading up on AR-15s. It seems like, during the Great Depression, we didn't have people having shootouts outside of the bootleggers. People helped each other out.
You know what? You're right. And that would say, FEMA has concentration camps, but I would also suggest to you, my God, I would have thought it crazy that the NSA was listening to my conversations, but that just came out.
Okay, you got me.
How far removed is that from what he's saying?
I think they're very different things. I think the NSA listening to my conversations is a good reason to get politically active and elect civil libertarians, whether they are libertarian capital L on the right or whether they are civil libertarian progressives on the left. To elect people who are going to regulate within the constraints of the Fourth Amendment our intelligence agencies. I opened the show with the DEA now, it turns out, is doing this kind of stuff too, the Drug Enforcement Agency. And I'm with you on that. I know as a libertarian, you and I.
Agency, what keeps them in check? It's our.
Well, it should be Congress. And I'm with you on that. But I don't think what keeps them in check is you and me and about 35 of our friends having a whole pile of guns.
What did Hitler do when he went to power? He went and made sure no one had any guns, so he wouldn't have any options.
No, Hitler actually didn't do that. Hitler sponsored gun clubs for young white Aryan youth.
Well, if you weren't an enemy of the Nazi Party, of course, but if you were a Jew or some other undesirable, your name was on the list nicely put together by the Weimar Republic, because these people were law-abiding and following the law, and Hitler went straight to that list and de-armed.
It wasn't a list of gun owners, Noel. It was a list of Jews.
I do. We got the executive, which is the presidency. We have the legislative, which is the House and the Congress, the Senate. And then, of course, there's the judiciary, which are our courts. And then we have us, the people. And what gives us our checks and balances on the other three branches is our right to vote. But if our right to vote is ignored, as so succinctly acknowledged by Justice Kaczynski from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, if it's ignored when our votes mean nothing...
Then you think we have a right to shoot?
Which gives it any meaning, any right, any substance at all.
Then you think we have a right to shoot if our right to vote is ignored? Are you saying that we have a right to shoot if our right to vote is ignored?
I'm saying we have the right to protect ourselves and defend our Constitution.
Okay, who do we shoot at?
Served by the government.
Who do we shoot at?
Those who want to destroy it, those who are affecting freedoms,
for example,
following the rule of law. That's why I take a serious issue with the Southern Poverty Law Center calling Oath Keepers a militia group, saying a militia group is in contrary to our government.
So who are those people who want to take away our liberties that we should be shooting at?
I'm not saying we should shoot anybody, but I am saying we have the right to a Second Amendment, as our founding fathers intended, to prevent a tyrannical government. And people will say, well, Noel, the crazy conspiracy theorist, you've got to protect yourself from the government. You know what? We've already had a tyrannical government come to power here in the United States.
When?
Back in the Reconstruction South, if you were a black man, a black American, you couldn't know.
Oh, well, we started out that way.
Deny that amendment.
Yeah, okay. All right. Noel Flasterstein, the website gunrightsforyou.com. Thanks, Noel.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fascinating stuff. It still spooks me. And I read the Turner Diaries. I'll tell you about that after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In the kind of since you asked category, on Sunday I was on CNN along with Michael Medved, who is a conservative talk show host that I have debated many, many times in public forums in front of thousands of people. and on the radio as well, and we have debated on each other's programs in a whole variety of ways. Michael's a decent man. He's a conservative, but he's a decent guy and a very smart man. I disagree with him on just about everything, but I respect him. And we were also joined by Michael Harrison on CNN. Michael Harrison is the publisher of Talkers Magazine, which is sort of the Bible of the talk radio industry. And the topic was this whole big thing around how this news report came out last week that Cumulus, which is the second largest owner of radio stations in America, is thinking about taking Rush and Sean off 50 of their stations, more or less, and putting their own talent on, putting on Huckabee or whatever. And a lot of progressives are waving the flag saying, see, we brought down Limbaugh. Not so fast. Here's what's happening, just to, you know, lay it out for you. In New York City, Clear Channel just bought WOR. WOR is this enormous legacy station. It's this massive stick in New York City. Lots and lots of people have always listened to. I mean, it goes back to the days when radio stations only had three letters in their call sign. It's one of the old legacy stations. Clear Channel just bought it. Clear Channel owns Premiere, which is the syndicating company that syndicates Rush's show. Rush basically works for Clear Channel, for Premiere. So, but Rush's show in New York City is on WABC, which is owned by Cumulus. And at the end of the year, that contract is up. And it looks to me, I have no inside information on these negotiations, but just looking at this, if Clear Channel moves Rush onto their own station, they make more money because they don't, you know, they recapture those local advertising minutes that right now Cumulus is getting in WABC. And if WABC puts their own talent on their own station or stations, then they make more money. So it looks to me, I said this on TV, I think this is just more vertical integration of the radio market. And, you know, as to whether the boycott hurt Limbaugh, yeah, it did. Apparently. I mean, you know, I know a number of advertisers dropped him. On the other hand, there's a lot of advertisers in line. I mean, you know, for people just buy cum. They just buy gross numbers. And they buy them from syndicators regardless of whether it's a liberal show or a conservative show. And what we saw back when that boycott was really taking effect and having some effect was that the revenue for our program went down. The revenue, I know for our syndicator, the company that syndicates our show, I know that their revenue went down. I was told this by senior executives, by the CEO, and which impacted not just my show, but all the progressive shows that are syndicated by that company. So, you know, I never said much about the boycott on the air because I have a certain ambivalence about it. I think that boycotts are good ways to express moral outrage. I remember the grape boycott that Cesar Chavez with the United Farm Workers did back in the late 60s in California. It didn't hurt the grape growers economically, but it did raise consciousness about what was going on, and that put so much pressure on the grape growers that they cleaned up their behavior and they allowed a union. And I would suggest that probably to the extent that this boycott has been effective with Limbaugh, it's been effective in maybe causing him to think a little more carefully before he opens his mouth. But I don't even know that. What I do know is that if you want to mobilize people to support progressive talk radio, which is how this was characterized by one of the people involved in the boycott, was that this was Limbaugh dropping off Cumulus stations was a big victory for progressive talk radio. Well, it's not. It's a big victory for Clear Channel. If you want to have a victory for progressive talk radio, start petitioning radio stations to put progressive talk radio on the air. Put your efforts there. There's a lot of good programming. You know, Bill Press, Stephanie Miller, Red Schultz, me, Randy Rhodes, and she's syndicated by Clear Channel, so they're already out there doing that. Mike Malloy, Norman Goldman. And there's a whole bunch of people who are not syndicated by the company that syndicates my show that are, you know, the Brad Friedman. And there's just a bunch of people doing good programming out there. I don't want to start the list because I'll inevitably forget somebody. But there's a good list of progressive shows out there. We should be promoting those rather than, in my opinion, rather than trying to take down anybody. Because you hit radio, and what was happening was a lot of advertisers were simply saying, and I know at least one said this to me, that we're just pulling all our advertising from All Talk Radio. We don't want to be in the middle of controversy. Because they were getting so many calls and so many emails and so much flack about Limbaugh's show. So they just said, that's it. We're out of here. And it wasn't political at all. It was a business decision. And that's what I see this as. And so, anyhow, just for the record. Now, back to Tim McVeigh and that whole thing. There was this book written back in the day that suggested that at the end of, there would be a great crash, in part brought about by a good white patriot, the book's called The Turner Diaries, brought about by a good white patriot blowing up a federal building and killing a lot of people, that would cause the government to clamp down with such a heavy fist that the patriots in America, the good white patriots, would rise up with their guns and overthrow that government and kill all the people of color and kill all the people who were Jewish and end up ruling America with just WASPs, basically. Maybe a few Catholics, but all white people. And Tim McVeigh read that and was inspired by it, and off he went to the races. David Koresh had read that. That kind of thinking, that we need to get guns to get ready for the quote end times. I think there's a normal human impulse to acknowledge our own mortality and project it out to say, okay, I know I'm going to die, so therefore it must be everything's going to die, or it must be that the end of the world is coming. But I don't think the end of the world is coming. I think there's going to be an economic pop, but we'll get through it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We've gotten through them before without massive amounts of guns. This is a very different thing from overthrowing an occupying force from a foreign country, which is what we did in 1776. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. This DEA thing, I promised to tell you about this, and I find this absolutely shocking, and I'm surprised that this isn't like at the front of the New York Times and that more people aren't talking about this. Reuters is reporting on this. They did the investigative research and dug this out. And what the Drug Enforcement Administration has been doing, under the guise of Nixon's war on drugs, is basically spy on everybody. Now, let me back up a little bit and explain what I think is the theory behind this. One of the classic ways that countries that are devolving into something less than free and open societies move is by selective enforcement of the law. If you can create a law where a large percentage of your citizens are criminals, are lawbreakers, and then only prosecute people for it, or only aggressively prosecute people for it, when it's convenient or profitable or politically useful to you, then you fundamentally change the nature of society. For example, in China, my understanding, I don't know if this is the case right now, but it was some 5 years ago or so, the first time I wrote about this. In China, it was illegal to move out of your home city without the permission of the police. And when you moved to a new city, you had to register with the police and all that kind of thing. Well, I mean, this is a law that goes way back to Mao's times. When the industrialization of China really picked up speed 15, 20 years ago, people started moving like crazy into the big cities. And they didn't bother to get permission. In fact, in many cases, they didn't know who to get permission from. In most cases, they didn't even know about the law. So now you've got probably half the population of China is a lawbreaker. So when they want to round somebody up, hey, did you move with permission? No? Okay, off to prison with you. So, pot. Somewhere between 10 and 20% of Americans have at some point smoked pot in their lives. Maybe higher than that, if you look at throughout their entire lives. There are some estimates that 10% of Americans are smoking pot this year. I mean, the numbers are mind-boggling. It's a multi-billion dollar, perhaps a trillion dollar industry in the United States. So if you have this declaration of war, which Richard Nixon did on people who smoke pot and take any other drug, and then you have an agency that's devoted to that drug war, the Drug Enforcement Agency, or administration. I don't know if the A stands for agency or administration, whatever it is, the DEA. Then they have all these special spying capabilities and powers because, after all, they're committed to this war. Well, it turns out that there's a division within the DEA that is supposed to be top secret. It's called the Special Operations Division, or SOD, S-O-D. Its work is so classified that when Reuters learned about it, they were asked not to even reveal where in Virginia the headquarters is located. And what they do, there's a document that was given to agents. It says, remember that the utilization of SOD cannot be revealed or discussed in any investigative function. In other words, they use this super spy part of the DEA to track somebody down and bust them. But they don't actually bust them. Instead, they find them doing something else, some other crime, not necessarily a drug crime, if I'm reading this right. This is from the Reuters report. The document specifically directs agents to omit the SOD's involvement from investigative reports, affidavits, discussions with prosecutors, and courtroom testimony. Agents are instructed to then use normal investigative techniques to recreate the information provided by SOD. So we've got this super secret, essentially out of control spy agency operating inside the DEA, and when they hand information off to judges, to prosecutors, to defendants, to anybody, they conceal their own existence by saying, okay, we found this out through the SOD techniques, and we're waiting for an Edward Snowden there. What are their techniques? We don't know. But because we don't want to reveal the existence of this, we're going to, now that we know that Joe Blow is smoking pot, we're going to, you know, ask the local police officer to walk by his house with a drug sniffy dog tomorrow, and, oh, gee, look at that. In other words, let's recreate the crime, or recreate the discovery of the crime. The DEA has helicopters. They have gunships. They probably have drones. When they bust you, they get to keep your stuff, including your money. And they share information with the NSA, the FBI, etc. This is from a post by Jack Pine Radical over at democraticunderground.com. Titled, Do You Get the Real Significance of the DEA Surveillance Story? Wow, just wow. This is, America's surveillance state. Now, again, I totally disagree with Representative Matt Shea that's a reason for us to go out and buy 15, you know, AR-16s or whatever, the AR-14s. Or any. I mean, he didn't specify a number or even a type of weapon, but you get my point. It is a good reason for us to wake up and get involved and participate in our political activities. Robert in Chicago, you wanted to disagree with me about this?
Good evening. Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. What's up?
Basically, I just want to give you a couple of quotes. And have you ever heard of the MIAC report? It comes out of the Mississippi. It basically assesses the new terrorists. And in one of their reports, they say that people that believe in the Constitution, Christians, gun owners, Tea Party members, and returning veterans are going to be the new terrorists.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, and I wouldn't agree with that as a blanket statement. Although you look at Tim McVeigh, and he was a returning veteran, but you can't take any of those groups and paint them with that kind of a broad brush. I mean, that's slanderous.
Well, that, but that's what our government is doing.
I don't
think
so.
I mean, look at, remember the quote from the reporter from Salon. Let's hope this is a, from the Boston bombing. Let's hope this is a white man. Or a white, a right-wing white extremist, or something along those lines.
Not a Middle Eastern Muslim, basically.
Yeah, well, I mean, and why would we hope that it's a Middle Eastern Muslim? You know, see, that's the problem. It's.
Well, he was hoping that it wasn't, because then we'd have another war on our hands.
Well, you know, our government's very good at killing brown people, but the reason I wanted to speak to you is because there's a couple of quotes that I have. One of them is from Dwight D. Eisenhower, which I think is very telling. And it talks about our military-industrial complex. I'm sure you've heard that before. But he also says, you know, the total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must be alert to the danger that public policy could itself become the cap of a scientific, technological elite.
That last part is not part of the quote. I have the actual quote here. I can play it for you if you want, and that's not what he said.
No, I do. I'm actually looking at the text. The first part of what I said was actually the beginning of the quote, and the second part is actually at the end. The first part of it talks about how much we spend on the military and how we, you know, the amount of iron we use to build a battleship can build so many bridges.
No, you're mixing up two different speeches. That's the Cross of Iron speech, which he gave before the American Society of Newspaper Editors in 1954. And the speech that you started with was his farewell address in 1961, in January of 1961, when he was leaving office. But no matter what Dwight Eisenhower said, you know, and no matter what anybody said, the fact of the matter is right now maybe you and I agree, we have a security state that has run amok. I don't see that as a reason to buy guns.
I believe what has happened is bankers control everything. And they don't care about Republican and Democrat. They don't care about the ideas and principles of free rights and individual rights and natural law. What they care about is power. You know, just like in the movie 1984, you know, what is it that you desire? You know, an everlasting footprint on the face of humanity.
Right.
And that's what this is. They want to control everything. They want to know everything. They want to literally sit here and decide what you think. Just like Eric Schmidt, the head of Google, said, we know what you're thinking before even you do. Yeah. Then you had Bill Gates at the TED conference talk about emissions.
So, Robert, what would you do about it?
I'll tell you what I'm doing about it. Basically, I am trying to pull myself as much off of the dependency of going to the grocery store and buying genetically modified food, which is not only absolutely horrible for you, but it's
rational thing to do, and it'll improve your health.
Exactly. I do have firearms, and I do have a little bit of ammo. I am learning how to use a bow. I am learning how to fish. The whole idea is to become as independent and self-sufficient as possible, because that is the number one enemy of a totalitarian government. They need you dependent. They need you stupid. They need you sick. And they need.
I think the biggest enemy of a totalitarian government is community, is people working together, people forming community, people being together. I mean, I don't think that it's the individual guy with a gun standing up saying, you know, I Claudius, I Ayn Rand. But, Robert, I guess we're going to have to agree to disagree. We're out of time. Thanks a lot for the call. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, who, again, I keep asking this question, who do these people think they're going to shoot? Speaking of truth to multinational corporations, we'd really rather they didn't know anything about. Tom Hartman here with you, and Harry in Seattle. Hey, Harry, what's up?
Oh, you know, I wanted to say something about the end times religious thing, but, you know, I was wondering if anybody in the Democratic Party is going to challenge Hillary. I think that there ought to be somebody who is going to stand up and say, you know, I think that maybe we need to move a little further to the left than she is. And I think Bernie Sanders ought to run just to keep
it honest. Well, he won't. But if you want a woman who could bring the woman's vote with her and is more progressive than Hillary, look at Elizabeth Warren. There's a huge draft Elizabeth Warren movement. I do, however, think that she's not going to jump in. She's and I do think that, assuming that Hillary Clinton can keep her health and her politics and her family together between now and the election, and let's hope that she does, just, you know, as good human beings, that there's a very good chance that she will be the Democratic nominee and that she may be the next president. And so I would be more interested in putting a lot of attention and effort into trying to move the entire Democratic Party, which she has to respond to, in a more progressive direction. If we can get, I mean, look at what has happened with the Tea Party. The Tea Party basically took over the Republican Party, and now they've got moderates like John Boehner dancing like he's a right-wing crazy. They've got Mitch McConnell now scared to death that he's going to get primaried in his own state, behaving like a Tea Partier in the United States Senate. I mean, I don't think it's good for America. I don't think it's good for the Republican Party, because these people are basically, you know, the creatures of a couple of billionaires who decided to put this thing together, rather than, you know, a genuine grassroots democratic movement. But I think it's a lesson for us that if activists can really get active in the party and can take political power, can get elected to political office, can get inside the party, can become precinct committee chair people, they will move the nominees, they will move the candidates in the direction that they want them to move. Mitt Romney moved far to the right from where he was just, you know, 10 years ago. Radically far to the right.
Hillary say that she's going to defund the DEA.
Well, you know, here's the thing. The public sentiment for ending Nixon's drug war is so great that while I doubt Hillary would ever defund the DEA, I think it's entirely possible that, you know, within 2 years she will be coming out and saying she's in favor of decriminalizing pot, the same way it took a couple of years for Obama, for the pressure to get large enough, you know, great enough for him to do what he knew was the right thing and say that he supported gay marriage. So that would be the strategy that I would take, Harry, although we are so far out right now, who knows what's going to happen? I certainly don't. I would prefer to see Elizabeth Warren as president of the United States to pretty much anybody right now. That's not an anti-Hillary Clinton statement, although I think that, you know, Hillary has some downsides, and I can list them, but I think she has a lot of upsides, too, and anybody would be better than whoever the Republicans are going to put up. So, Harry, thanks for the call. We got a bunch of calls here. Let's get some in. James in Bonita Springs, Florida. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I was listening to the discussion on the Snowden and NSA surveillance thing
mm-hmm.
last week, and can you hear me?
Yeah. Just fine.
Okay. And I suddenly remembered who it was who started the whole program back in 2002. And if you think back then, it was Reagan's former national security advisor, a guy by the name of Admiral John Poindexter. Remember
sure.
him?
Yeah. With his...
The original program was called Total Information Awareness. And if you look that up, the scope of it is huge, even bigger than what didn't reveal that the NSA is actually doing.
Yeah, the all-seeing eye. Yes, I remember that. And in fact, I remember going off on that. Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, at one point in 2003, I think it was, Russ Feingold threatened to stop the whole program.
Yep.
It's too bad he didn't.
Yeah, he shortly thereafter ended up dead. Not that there's necessarily a correlation between the two, but it is an interesting coincidence. James, thank you for the call. Vicki in Valley Springs, California. Hey, Vicki.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thank you. What's up?
Good. My issue was, well, as you were talking about the issue with, do you think that should this come down, that they would actually come to our homes and remove us from our homes, or...
No, I don't think the if the they that you're talking about is the United States government, I don't
powers
think,
that be or whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't think they have any interest in us, you know, in average working people. You know, if anything, they would.
Then they're just taking all our information for no reason. I mean, like you said, they're conveying it to the.
I think what happened. I think what happened here is that after, you know, 9/11 happened, and George Bush and Dick Cheney were so terrified by this. I mean, they responded like terrified children, and I think they genuinely had PTSD. That could have been the White House. It, you know, and you know, they, in fact, the plane that went down in Pennsylvania was probably heading for the White House, and they, you know, and out of their terror, out of their fear, they basically said, you know, daddy, save me, you know, create some giant thing. I mean, keep in mind, George's dad was the head of the CIA at one point in time. So, yeah, turn to the intelligence agencies, give them everything they want, give them unlimited power, and it was a bad idea, and we need to wake up from that fear. Vicki, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Gerald in Belafonte, Pennsylvania. Last minute of this hour is yours, Gerald.
Yeah, you said that boycotts are probably a bad idea because they limit support for all talk radio.
That's.
And I wanted to point out the ways to support progressive talk radio.
Okay.
One, give the free speech TV because that gives you guys a vehicle to get out there.
Yep.
Number two, sponsors of progressive radio shows, support them and then tell them why you're supporting them. That's
yep.
really important. Tell them why.
It does make a big difference.
You know? And the last thing I just wanted to point out that I'm 59, and other than when I was in the military, since I'm not a hunter, I have never needed a firearm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Well, I'm in the same neighborhood age-wise, and I've never needed a firearm. I you know, when I visit my brother Steve, he's got a bunch of them, and I love to target practice with him. They're fun. But, you know, we don't, like, go out walking around in the streets with them. It's like, that's nuts. So, Gerald, thank you for the call. And great to hear from you. And thanks for the good suggestions. They are good suggestions. We'll be right back. It's just a minute before the top of the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And William Yeatman. How do you say it, William?
Oh, it's Yeatman.
Yeatman, that's what I thought. William Yeatman is with us, policy analyst and with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. William, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. You guys are coming out. Actually, the Republicans in Congress just proposed H.R. 367, which would basically, maybe this is not the Regulations from Executive in Need of a Scrutiny Act in 2013, that basically prevents Congress from passing a carbon tax. Do I have that right?
It was an amendment to that legislation, the
uh-huh.
RAINS Act. And
okay.
Whereas I can't speak intelligently about the RAINS Act, the amendment would forbid the executive, so the presidency, from imposing a price on carbon without the consent of the people's elected officials in Congress.
Okay. So, question. Who owns the atmosphere?
Who owns the atmosphere?
Right.
I would, global commons, I'd imagine.
Okay, so
I mean, legally, I think
so we all own the atmosphere, right?
It is as an ownership, I don't know whether or not we've got defined property rights over the atmosphere, but it would collectively understood as such, yes.
Okay, so the atmosphere is the global commons. Why is it wrong for us to say that when somebody dumps waste and poison into our commons, that we would like them to pay for the cost of that waste?
I am 100% for such policies. I mean, and granted, I generally don't prefer that they be such problems, those of pollution, are rectified by the centralized state. I do allow that the most efficient response can come from the centralized state, but generally speaking, I prefer to allow the tort system to work that out.
But there's the commons is us collectively. The atmosphere can't walk into a courtroom and say, I'm suing. But at my point is that when the big oil companies, and the big refineries, you know, when the Koch brothers or when ExxonMobil or Chevron or whatever, Halliburton with their fracking, when they put poison into the air, and specifically I'm talking about carbon dioxide in this case, a pollutant that has been defined as such both by the EPA and by the U.S. Supreme Court. And when they put that stuff into the air, which changes the composition of the atmosphere, is killing off sea life by acidifying the oceans, If you don't believe in global warming, there's, you know, 98% of scientists say it's leading to global warming, but you're welcome to debate that. But whatever. When they put this carbon dioxide into the air, it's our air. What's wrong with saying to them, there is a cost to this pollution. That cost is $20 per ton, and we're going to recover that cost from you. I mean, if they're pouring poison in the street in front of my yard, I would expect the city to go after them.
Well, indeed. I mean, first I'll just note a couple things. One would be that the Supreme Court did not define greenhouse gases as a pollutant. I think the decision you're referring to, the 2007 Massachusetts v. EPA, what the Supreme Court decided there was that EPA had the authority, the agency did, to define greenhouse gases as a pollutant pursuant to the Clean Air Act. So that's a small
aside. Which they have done.
Which the EPA did indeed do in December of December.
But you're dancing around the edges of my question here.
Oh no!
It's a pretty straightforward question.
It was a straightforward question, but there were some inaccuracies. So I just wanted to clear those up for your listeners. But I think the ultimate issue is one you described. Who is to decide? I think the amendment before the Congress, before the House of Representatives to that bill, is who's going to decide? Should it be the people's representatives, with the power of the purse, that's the way the Constitution intended it, that the Congress decides such matters, such as a national tax?
But the Congress has already done that.
Or should it be decided by unelected bureaucrats at the Environmental Protection Agency?
But see, wait a second, William.
Americans would disagree with you that when you presumably what you're doing here is asserting that the executive should have the authority to impose a national tax. All I'm saying is that ought to be vetted and cleared by the people's elected representatives, and that seems to be pretty uncontroversial to me.
If we're speaking about a genuine tax, I don't disagree with you. But I think that what the Obama administration is talking about is a law which has already been passed by the people's representative, the Clean Air Act, which gives the executive branch, that is the president, the power to define the cost of pollution and to recover that cost. Now, I realize industry wants to call that a tax, but the EPA is not going to call it a tax. They're going to call it a fine or a fee. And there is nothing unconstitutional or illegal about it. And to use your phraseology, the people's representatives have already put that into law. The president is merely executing a law, or would be if he did this. I frankly doubt he'll do it, but I wish he would. Would simply be executing a law which is already in place.
Well, I mean, that law was enacted in 1970, and in 1970, no one was concerned about global warming. It wasn't on the radar.
And things have gotten a lot worse since then.
It
we need
wasn't
it.
Until 1974 that Time magazine put on its cover a headline about the potential for global cooling. So the notion that the Congress in 1970 approved a carbon tax is pretty far out there, and I'd go so far as to suggest that, well, actually, I would just suggest, and that's something I fervently hope, that before the executive imposed a carbon tax, that we put that before the people's representatives. If, as you claim, they've already approved this, then you shouldn't oppose this policy at all, because they'll just approve it again.
No, you're just trying to throw more barriers on it, and you know that John Boehner and Eric Cantor and the other crazies who are running the House of Representatives, Republicans who are running the House of Representatives, are not going to allow this to happen because they are owned by the fossil fuel industry and the Koch brothers.
Let's just follow your logic.
The law was passed in 1970. And the law was passed in 1970, and you say, we weren't talking about global warming. The Second Amendment to the Constitution was written in 1787, or 1788, arguably. It was ratified in 1791, as I recall. And that, at that point in time, there were not even bullets. How can you argue in favor of any right to bear arms or to own bullets based on the Second Amendment when it didn't even exist at that time? These modern-day weapons did not even exist at that time. That's the kind of logic which you're trying to use by saying in 1970, when the Clean Air Act was passed and the president was given the authority to define what was a pollutant and to charge an appropriate fee to polluters, You know, and didn't at that time think carbon dioxide was a pollutant. And there were people, by the way, in 1970 who were saying it was. You know, that's the logic. I mean, you can't have it both ways.
Tom, I mean, I never try to have it both ways. I don't give a hoot about gun control policy. That's not my bag. What I do is I do energy policy. And therefore, I guess I do know a thing or two about the Clean Air Act and carbon taxes and whatnot. So I'm not quite sure what your example, your analogy.
Okay, what I'm saying,
I'm not trying to have it both ways. But what I am trying to tell you is that no one in their right mind is going to tell you that in 1970, the nation's representatives were acting with climate change in mind when they enacted the
they
Clean
certainly
Air Act.
Were. Of course they were.
All I'm saying is that
they were saying no.
We impose a tax,
William, they were, and it wasn't. It isn't a tax; it's a fee. And they were saying that. And they were saying that anything that, as time goes on, as science improves, and we identify new pollutants, the EPA has the power to recover the cost of that pollution, and that's all we're talking about doing here. And I get it that the fossil fuel industry doesn't want those costs recovered. They want you and me to pay the cost of those. They want to dump it on us. They want us to pay the cost of polluting the commons, but I think it's just wrong. William Yateman, he's at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. William, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you. I disagree with everything you just said, but thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's amazing how a fee on pollution becomes a carbon tax, although, frankly, we really need a carbon tax. Okay, from 2003 to 2008, U.S. gasoline prices went up 73%, and the economy grew 13%. What happened to gas usage? It froze. Because the price of gas went up. If you increase the carbon tax, if you put a carbon tax on gasoline, guess what? People are going to use less gas. It's really simple. And we can use that money to mitigate the disastrous effects of global warming, and we can use that money to develop alternative energy supplies. So it's straightforward stuff. I think it's just straightforward stuff. Kate in Hackensack, New Jersey. Hey, Kate, what's on your mind today?
Well, what's on my mind is if it should ever come to the dire consequences which you predicted earlier in the show, where you think you're going to have to use guns, you're not going to have to use anything. What you're going to have to do is not use something, and that's your computer. If you
right.
live by computer, if you're addicted to computers, just learn not to be. An hour a day.
Okay.
Without anything computerized. If you didn't know when you used computers on Monday, you'd take down the government in 24 hours.
Okay. Kate, that's probably actually quite a healthy prescription. There was an interesting piece in Science News last week about how when people go camping, even over the weekend, it resets their biological clock because they start waking up early and going to sleep early. I mean, very quickly. Because when you're camping, you're exposed to the daylight early in the morning. And you're exposed to the dark at night, and your body recalibrates itself. There's something healthy about that. And sitting in front of a computer screen for hours and hours and hours of artificial light, especially after the sun has gone down, or a television for that matter, alters the way that our serotonin and melatonin systems work. And that actually makes us more vulnerable to things like cancer. Roy in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Roy, what's up?
Okay, it's Ray, but that's okay. It's no
Ray, I'm sorry. Yeah, it says Ray.
Yeah. You know, my comments are about that first guest you had on today, and I'd like to kind of talk about it from a clinical perspective.
We're talking about, just if I may, just for the people who just tuned in and don't know what you're talking about.
Okay.
Our first guest was a fellow who was saying that he wasn't quite going as far as the fellow we were talking about, but the fellow we were talking about is a state representative who was arguing that everybody should be getting guns because an economic disaster is coming. His name is Matt Shea, and he's a state representative in the state of Washington. Arm up, get ready. And I was just asking, you know, who do you think you're going to be shooting at when the disaster comes? Go, your turn.
Yeah, and from a clinical biochemical perspective, what's happening is millions of people are being encouraged to have anxiety disorders.
Yes.
You know, the ability to imagine potential threats in advance, I mean, that's a helpful thing, could even be life-saving. But anxiety, in the end, is a figment of imagination. It's about things that haven't happened yet and often never do or never will. So one way to define an anxiety disorder is people spend too much time in their imagination instead of here and now. And that's where millions of people are being encouraged to spend their time and do every day. Then there's the question of just how realistic that imaginations are. And that's where people like Beck, Limbaugh, and Hannity, and a whole bunch of other people have come in for so long now. What they do so well is create these possible and plausible scenarios for people, but they're highly unlikely. And what it does is it blurs the line between reality and what's imagination for so many people. And then they frame those things in a way that most people would tend to think would be awful, like using words like communism and socialism and dictator and tyranny, you know, especially for somebody who grew up in a Cold War, all those things are very inflammatory. And they do it so well. And I think what you're seeing now is the result of that. That's been going on for years now, and now you've got people literally plugging themselves into their fight-or-flight responses needlessly over figments of their imagination. And quite frankly, it's pretty scary from a political point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree. And you know, one of the apropos of that, one of the things I've observed over the years is that people who are constantly imagining a scary future tend to, and it becomes part of their lives, tend to suffer from anxiety disorders. Those are the high, thin, screechy kinds of emotions. And the people who suffer from the low, dark, thick, you know, awful emotions tend to be the ones who instead are imagining the past and continuously re-experiencing shame or guilt, and that leads to depression, to depressive disorders. And there's a spectrum of these things that have to do with past and future, that have to do with the intensity of the imagination or recollection, or imagined recollection for that matter. And
you're talking about with depression, that's so-called ruminating, where you just go over and over. But see, that's another factor here is brain physiology. If you simply hear something over and over again or repeat it to yourself, and it might be ruminating, literally facts start to feel like, or opinions start to feel like facts, and imagination starts to feel like reality to you. And that's what's going on with, because that's what those guys do so well. If you listen to them day after day, there's always that repetition. And if nothing else, there's an underlying theme that they keep hitting over and over and over again. And just millions of people just don't see how they're being manipulated. And I think we're starting to see the results of that, of years of that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Ray, Shano tells me that you are the recipient today of our book, our autographed copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country by Tom Hartman, and compliments of stamps.com. So if you would like it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
sure.
Let me put you on hold, and Danielle will get
get
your information. Thanks for calling, Ray. Danielle, he's on line 3. Wayne in Granby, Mass., listening to WHMP. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I guess you remember back in the 70s when we had the two major gas shortages. The rumor was around that, oh, my God, the oil companies have bottlenecked a potential alternative-type fuel research thing, that they were going to release it or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that's all true or not.
The super carburetor and the engine that runs on water. Yeah, I remember them.
Well, all that stuff. But even if any of it's a little bit true, why in the world haven't people like the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil and the other gas stations gotten involved in it? And, you know, can't they be making a ton of money off this stuff just like they can with...
Because it's not true. It's wishful thinking. The reality is, I used to own a car, a Honda Insight, back in 97. Louise and I bought one. We ultimately sold it after 2 years because I just couldn't fit in it. It was too small for me. I couldn't sit up straight. But it got 73 miles to the gallon. I mean, there's a car on the market right now, and has been for, a decade and a half, that gets 73 miles to the gallon. So there are alternatives, and there are options, and there are directions that we can go. We just don't use them very well. Wayne, excellent call. Thank you, and excellent point. Thanks a lot for the call. There was a lot of, in the 70s, there were an enormous number of conspiracy theories flying around about the, when Nixon went to odd, even days and all that stuff. It was a very, very strange time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sort of like the modern-day conspiracy theories around, 9-11 or whatever. I mean, it's just any kind of big disaster or change causes everybody to speculate. If America socializes medicine, where will Canadians go? That's an interesting sign from a Tea Party. When this weekend there was a really, really great long article in the New York Times, as I recall, about how medical tourism now was about a guy who had a hip replacement and his insurance wouldn't cover it because they said that his hip problem was caused by arthritis and arthritis was a pre-existing condition. And the quote to get the hip replaced in the United States, paying for it out of pocket, was like $50,000 or more. And so he went to Belgium and got it done. He went to Europe, got it done for like $12,000. And it turns out that, you know, there, the people who sell the hips, the replacement hips, it's not just the doctor's fees, it's the cost of the actual hip itself. They have to sell them at a price that they negotiate with the government to anybody. Whereas here, they can charge you whatever they want. They're the only ones who make them. So, welcome to the wonderful world of for-profit medicine. Not quite that way in Belgium. Anyway, I thought it was fascinating. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's up? Carbon tax?
What?
Carbon tax, you want to talk about?
Yeah, why don't we just get rid of the carbon?
Well, that's
the easy way to do it.
How do you propose doing that?
Have our dry ice factories expand them and have them run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, until the carbon levels come down to whatever the heck it, you know, seems to be.
You know what powers those dry ice factories?
Huh?
You know what powers those dry ice factories?
Well, of course I know. Nuclear power. I mean, come on. Somewhere along the line, you know, it's like Santa Claus. It's
okay.
Nice story,
you know what powers the equipment that digs that uranium out of the ground and transports it and refines it?
Hey, I know what we could do. How about coal direct chemical looping? That produces power without making any pollution whatsoever.
If you can produce a commercial way to do it, I'm guessing you can make some serious bucks. I don't disagree that getting rid of the carbon is a good idea. In fact, that's the whole point of the carbon tax, is to reduce our reliance on carbon. Fact of the matter is, if we had a modest tax on carbon, $20, $30, $40 per ton, which is less than it is in some countries, that if we were to have that kind of a tax on carbon, that instantly, in many cases, and maybe even most cases, alternative energy sources, the simple, obvious ones like wind and solar, become more cost effective, become less expensive than fossil fuels. And it's just recapturing the costs. You know, it's no longer letting the Koch brothers dump their poisons in our air, their carbon dioxide poison. So I think it's a simple way to do it. Don in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hey, Don, we need a woman for president?
Yeah, I think we need a woman, and we also need a 21st century version of Theodore Roosevelt.
Okay, I agree with both points, but let me caution you about thinking that gender is the be-all and end-all to all things. The person who most inspired Ronald Reagan was Maggie Thatcher.
I don't think that at all. Yeah, Ronald Reagan was manufactured.
Well, he was inspired by Margaret Thatcher, who was elected 2 years earlier as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom in 1978.
Well, I don't think my choice would be a Margaret Thatcher.
Okay.
The ticket I'm looking at is Elizabeth Warren and Russ Feingold.
I would go for that.
You would.
By the way, earlier I said Russ Feingold died. I was confusing him.
No.
Yeah, with Paul Wellstone. I'm very sorry for anybody who got and my apologies to Russ Feingold for saying you're dead. You're not. He's not. He's still around.
I hope Russ wasn't listening.
Yeah, me too. It's been a long weekend. I've been editing a book all weekend, and I haven't had enough sleep. Anyway.
Okay. Have a great day, and thanks for taking my call.
Thanks a lot for the call, Don. Yeah, it's a good one. Bill in Franklin, Kentucky. Hey, Bill, what's up? House of Representatives?
Hey. Yes. Hey, Tom. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
Really do. My thought was I'm in Kentucky, of course, and the size of the county was determined on the length of time a one-day ride on a horse to the courthouse. That was how the counties were sized.
Oh, that's
interesting. I was thinking about, so you wanted to be represented. And what I was thinking is, you know, why don't we represent ourselves with computers and the House of Representatives, let them take care of the administration point, and get all the lobbyists to start lobbying the public instead of the Congress or the Senate.
Yeah, what you're talking about is direct democracy. the old Athenian-style democracy, although even that was somewhat representative because people served in their equivalent of a Congress or Parliament by lottery. But the problem I see with that bill, I lived in Oregon when a ballot initiative was passed that said that it requires that the Oregon legislature could not raise personal income taxes without a two-thirds vote of the legislators. But and they passed another one, and again, these were ballot initiatives. These were not passed by the legislature. They were passed by the people. They passed another one that said that if the government has a surplus at the end of the year, or the biennium, actually, it's the Oregon works on a two-year calendar with a part-time legislature, that if at the end of these 2 years there's money left over in the state treasury, they have to take that money, divide it up among all the people who are the taxpayers based on how much they paid in taxes, and write checks and pass it back out. It's called the kicker. So multimillionaires and billionaires would get very, very large six-figure, seven-figure checks back from the state, and somebody who paid, you know, $25 in state income taxes might get a dollar back from the state. And the vast majority of Oregonians get virtually nothing in the kicker. They get $5, $8, $10, $12. But it sounded like such a great idea. Money left over at the end of the year, two-thirds majority to raise taxes. And what happened as a consequence of this was that at the end of the year 2008, the state of Oregon had money left over. They had to pass that money out. And then the Bush crash happened, and all of a sudden tax collections dropped dramatically, and the state was in deep, deep doo-doo. And in order to just maintain state functions, they needed to raise taxes, not hugely, but slightly, in order to be able to continue to pay, like, unemployment, you know, benefits and things and run the government. But they couldn't, because the Republicans had enough seats in the legislature that they would not allow, they would not, you know, go along with that two-thirds requirement. These were laws or amendments to the Constitution or changes in law that were that the people voted on, that were proposed by billionaires and their buddies and their think tanks specifically to produce the outcome that I just described. Their idea was that this is the only way we can over time destroy the government, shrink the government, is by making it impossible for them to get revenue and forcing them to give away any kind of surplus. And it worked. I mean, it really, really, really harmed the people of Oregon and the state of Oregon. And that's why I would be very wary about that. As long as advertising works, as long as big corporations can spend money and it's called free speech, you're not going to have a direct democracy that functions because people are gullible, people are vulnerable. It's why I think it's a good idea to have a representative democracy like we have. Am I making sense?
I was trying to think of a way to get the lobbyists to lobby the people more than the government. You know, because we're the ones that will eventually be at the bottom line.
But here's how the lobbyists would lobby us, Bill. They would do it the same way that they did in Oregon with a kicker and with the two-thirds majority. The billionaires would buy really, really sweet-sounding television ads with little old ladies and nice housewives and good-looking young men in them who would be saying to us, you know, this is just the right thing to do. We need to, it's the people's money. It needs to go back to the people. Or, you know, you want your taxes raised? I don't want my taxes raised. We Congress should think about this seriously. There should be at least two-thirds. And most people, you know, if the taxes in Oregon were raised by a percent or so, it would cost them an extra $25 a year. But they don't realize that. They're not thinking like that. And so the way that they lobby the people is with advertising, millions and millions of dollars of television and radio advertising. And I used to think the ballot initiatives were the best thing since sliced bread because it's direct democracy. Having lived in a state that has it and having seen the kind of damage they do, and you look in California, Prop 13 did the same thing, Prop 5, there's others. I've grown to be very wary of direct democracy. But Bill, good idea. I mean, you know, keep them coming. We got to come up with something here. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on your first guest. I thought he was really smug and arrogant. I mean, it's ridiculous to say that because in 1970 We didn't know that carbon dioxide was an air pollutant that, you know, the EPA can't regulate it today. And as a taxpayer and as a citizen, I expect the EPA to protect the environment, not, you know, the interests of people who they are regulating. That is not what I had in mind when I look at regulatory agencies. Unfortunately, that is exactly what happens, but the intent of those agencies is to regulate, and I want them to do it, and I want them to do it very strictly. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just think it's ridiculous. Obviously, we as the public cannot know everything that there is to know about the dangers of different pollutants in the environment. I don't have a PhD in environmental engineering or anything that would remotely make me, make that information available to me. And, you know, the intent of those regulatory agencies is to protect the public. And unfortunately, it's not done because the public is not really involved in the agency in the sense that, industry comes involved.
Yeah, and part of that is lobbying. Part of that is the revolving door. There's a lot of pieces to that that need to be fixed. Good point, John. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now the Prince Priebus is saying, NBC, CNN, you do a documentary on Hillary Clinton, we won't let you have our debates.
Really?
Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you 10 minutes before the hour, and let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com to find out what's going on in the world. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
Well, we've got a little more information about this terror threat that we've been talking about in maddeningly vague terms.
The one that has caused the shutdown of U.S. embassies around the world.
Exactly, and caused the State Department to issue a worldwide travel alert for the full month of August. Well, the decision resulted from intercepted electronic communications in which the head of Al-Qaeda in Pakistan ordered the leader of its affiliate in Yemen, which is the terror organization's most lethal branch, to carry out an attack as early as this past Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And the intercepted conversations last week were between Ayman al-Zawahiri, who succeeded bin Laden as the head of Al-Qaeda, and Nasser al-Wahushi, who's the head of the Yemen-based Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And American intelligence officials and lawmakers are saying that this revealed one of the most serious plots against American and other Western interests since the attacks on September the 11th, 2001.
Isn't it? I mean, I'm assuming this information you're sharing with us did not come via Edward Snowden, that it came from official sources. Is that correct?
That's correct. This is coming from American officials.
And are these not the same official sources who say, oh, my God, if anybody releases any of the details of an operation against the United States by somebody like Ayman al-Zawahiri, that will damage our national security?
Well, you see, what's interesting is that the stories that came out over the weekend did not give this much detail.
Mm-hmm.
They just said that there was a terror threat.
Right.
And it was very specific. But McClatchy newspapers yesterday published the names.
Uh-huh.
Said it was Pakistan, said it was Yemen, said it was Ayman al-Zawahiri and Nasser al-Wahushi. And as a result of that, the White House gave permission or basically cleared it for other people and said, yeah, okay, if you've, go ahead. So other people had held off. For example, the New York Times, at the request of senior American intelligence officials on Friday and Saturday, had that information.
And did not publish it.
And did not publish it.
Hmm. Interesting.
But McClatchy did on Sunday.
Okay.
And when the government became aware of that, it dropped its objections to the Times publishing it.
Hmm.
So the Times, which is not loath to publish things which are going to embarrass the government,
right,
held off, presumably because they thought it could be dangerous.
Right.
So So that's what we know. But, of course, you know, there was an interesting question in the briefing today about the timing of this and about how it changes the conversation about the NSA surveillance programs.
Right.
And, you know, Jay Carney would not be drawn on that.
I don't know what to do with this. You know, I know that there are Republicans who are running around saying, oh, this is just, you know, the administration trying to scare us. I mean, it's saying basically the same things that I was saying when George Bush would, during the election with John Kerry, kept bumping the threat alert up to red, you know, code red.
This is the first time the president's done this.
Uh-huh.
In 5 years.
Okay.
Really? I mean, you know, I think that it seems to me that a couple of things could be going on. I think that there could be a very real threat. I think that it may be that this is happening at a convenient time for the administration to change the conversation on the NSA surveillance.
Yep.
And sometimes things happen at convenient times.
Yes. Okay.
Well. But I don't know if there's more to it than that. Apparently, the NSA's PRISM program was the part of the NSA surveillance program that was responsible for the intercept.
Mm-hmm.
But there were other aspects of this that also helped them put the pieces together. So it wasn't only one intercept that put everything together here.
Right. So, in other words, they need to keep all of their spy programs in place.
No. There was the posting on jihadist forums by Amin al-Zawahiri last week calling for attacks on Americans.
Huh.
He did that. There was also Yemeni officials came to the White House last week on an official visit, very senior Yemeni officials. There was talk that they briefed White House officials on possible attacks. There was a question about that at the White House today. Jay Carney was very circumspect in his answer to that.
Hmm. Okay. Have you been following this DEA thing?
Yes, I wrote about it. I got that on my Twitter feed at 5:30 this morning and nearly fell off my chair.
What's the deal here? I was wondering out loud earlier if this might be one of the reasons why there's so much pushback against decriminalizing pot, because it's one of the things that allows the DEA to continue existing.
You know, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it from that point of view. I don't know. I mean, it's quite extraordinary that there's a secretive DEA unit funneling info to authorities to help them launch criminal investigations of Americans, that Americans don't know the timing of the launch of the investigation so that they can't effectively challenge the evidence against them.
Right. The DEA being the Drug Enforcement Administration.
The Drug Enforcement Administration.
Yeah. Huh. Or agency or whatever it is.
Yeah. It's quite an extraordinary story. Reuters had it exclusively. It's showing up other places now.
Yeah.
So I would urge your listeners to go to the Reuters story. They've got the most detail on it. It's quite unbelievable, and this has been going on for some considerable time.
Yes. What else is up in the world?
Another thing that's up in the world is that a new study by Third Way, a centrist think tank, found that the marketplace for firearms on the Internet, where buyers are not required to undergo background checks, is so vast that advocates for stricter regulations now consider online sales a greater threat than the gun show loophole.
Hmm.
They did a study and they found that thousands of guns, including so-called assault weapons, are for sale online, and that many prospective buyers were shopping online specifically to avoid background checks.
That makes perfect sense. Would the background check law that was proposed by the administration earlier in the year have closed that loophole too?
Yes, it would. The compromise one would.
It would have. Okay.
Yes.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, on Sunday's edition, yesterday's Fox News Sunday. Welcome back to the program, by the way. Third hour of our program, Tom Hartman here with you. Host Chris Wallace was interviewing Jim DeMint, the former senator, now the president of the Heritage Foundation. And he asked if the Republican Party was ready to, quote, shoot the hostage, end quote. Also known as shutting down the federal government over funding Obamacare. Here's the clip.
Some leading Republicans say this is crazy. Tom Cole says it's suicidal. Richard Burr, your former colleague in the Senate, says it is, quote, the dumbest idea I've ever heard. What are they missing? And but, Senator, you know, what they say is you don't take a hostage unless you're prepared to shoot him.
Right.
And if you're going to go down this road, are you prepared to shut down the government? Because the Democrats are not going to go along with this. Are you prepared to shut down the government?
Well, and unfortunately, DeMint dodged the question. He didn't say yes or no. And, you know, didn't say whether the Republicans were ready to shoot the hostage. Clearly, some of them are, some of them aren't. But the thing to keep in mind is that the hostage here is the American people and the American economy. Jim DeMint refused to answer Chris Wallace's question, but the real answer is that Republicans have been shooting the hostage ever since President Obama was first inaugurated. I mean, their hostage-taking plans were laid out back in the night of January 20th, 2009, when the president and, you know, a lot of the rest of us, I was here in Washington, D.C., I was living in Oregon at the time, were here attending inaugural balls. On that night, while the president and his wife were out dancing, he had just been sworn in, on that night, in a private room at the Caucus Room restaurant in Washington, D.C., about 14 blocks from where I'm sitting right now, Republican leaders plotted to intentionally sabotage and undermine the Obama presidency at every turn, no matter how much damage it did to the American people. Remember, at that time, 700,000 people a month were losing their jobs, and the American economy was in the most horrible tailspin since the Great Depression. And the Republicans wanted to keep it that way. As Robert Draper documented in his book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives, on the guest list for that four-hour invitation-only meeting were Republican congressmen, and they were all men, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, and Dan Lundgren. The Republican senators included Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, John Kyle, and the now president of the Heritage Foundation, Jim DeMint. Newt Gingrich was also in attendance. And on this program, just a few months ago, he bragged that the purpose of that dinner meeting was to come up with a plan to sabotage the Obama presidency. Here he is. And you were quoted in the book as saying that after this dinner, you'll remember this as the day the seeds of 2012 were sown. Is that all accurate?
Well, part of it.
So were you guys insurgents against the Obama presidency?
Well, the fact is, look, the opposition party ought to sit down and try to figure out how to get back in power. Mm-hmm. That's why they're the opposition party.
After all, you know, he said that. He said the opposition party ought to sit down and figure out how to try to get back in power. That's why they're the opposition party. You would think, though, that they would want to figure out how to get back into power not in a way that hurts people. I mean, during this dinner, the Republican conspirators vowed to bring Congress to a standstill, regardless of how badly congressional inaction would hurt the already hurting American economy and people. In essence, they pledged to each other to obstruct, filibuster, and block any legislation that might improve the economy and thus make President Obama look good. While the meeting at the Caucus Room restaurant was top secret, Republicans who were there were very frank about it. And just months later, well, you just heard, you know, Newt bragging about it, about what went on. Congressman Pete Sessions told the National Journal in March of 2009, you know, January, February, March, 3 months later, that the Republican sabotage plan was going to borrow a page from the tactics of the Taliban terrorists. He said that, and this is a verbatim quote, "Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire processes. And these Taliban is an example of how you go about to change a person from their messaging to their operations to their frontline message. and we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with Democrats on the other side. Texas Republican went on to say that if the Democrats do not give us those options or opportunities, then we will become insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude. At the caucus room dinner itself, Robert Draper quoted Congressman Kevin McCarthy as saying, "We've got to challenge them on every single bill. Show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies." End of quote. Looking back from 5 years later, we can see that that united and unyielding opposition, which Congressman McCarthy called for, has succeeded, is succeeding in harming America and thus preventing President Obama from having any significant progressive successes. Just ask Democratic Congressman Charlie Rangel. In an interview with the Daily Beast published last Friday, Charlie Rangel said that Republicans in the House are doing more damage to American competitiveness and to the American people than any terrorist organization. Here's what he said. This is what he told the Daily Beast. Quote, "What is happening is sabotage. Terrorists couldn't do a better job than the Republicans are doing." End of quote. Congressman Rangel is right there in the House of Representatives. He sees it going on every day. He knows these people up close and personal, and he is right. Republicans on Capitol Hill have been relentless in blocking any legislation that could improve the economy and might improve President Obama's popularity. Since President Obama took office, Republicans have filibustered a wide variety of bills that would have helped the American people in the economy. Those include President Obama's jobs bill, Nancy Pelosi's American Jobs, Closing Loopholes and Prevention of Outsourcing Act, which would have prevented the outsourcing of jobs overseas, and the Small Business Jobs and Tax Relief Act, which encouraged small businesses to hire by giving them temporary tax credits. Yes, the Republicans filibustered them. Just last week, Republicans vowed to block President Obama's attempts to cut corporate tax rates, something they've been saying for years they want, because to let him do that would be to give him one small victory. Republicans have always also worked very hard to tear down America. They've refused to increase funding for our nation's crumbling infrastructure, leaving us stuck in the 19th century. They voted to slash billions of dollars in the social safety net programs like food stamps and Medicaid, and radically slashed unemployment insurance. And in the most blatant form of shooting the hostage, Republicans pushed the devastating sequester on the American people, and afterwards John Boehner bragged that he got 90%, 99% of what he wanted. Since Boehner's sequester went into effect, millions of Americans have felt its impact. In Michigan alone, federal unemployment checks have fallen by 10.7% since last March, sucking about $150 a month out of unemployed people's budgets. In California, the Contra Costa County Meals on Wheels program has been forced to cut its budget by 5.1% because of the sequester, scale back the number of meals it brings to shut-in, disabled, and elderly poor people. And now, as the sequester cuts continue to ravage our country, Republicans are refusing to support President Obama's most recent jobs bill, which would have put millions of Americans back to work and would help solve our nation's poverty epidemic. Ever since his first inauguration, on that night, January 20th, 2009, Republicans have made it clear that they're very comfortable with shooting the hostage. And it seems that even Chris Wallace is beginning to realize that when it comes to Republicans being willing to shoot the hostage, it's really not a matter of if. It's a matter of how much longer they're going to keep doing it. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So do you see any solutions to the big solution I see to it is start calling them out, which is what I just did. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes summer. Suzanne in Greenfield, Massachusetts, listening to WHMP. Hey, Suzanne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a couple of comments about the gentleman that had called much earlier in your program and was talking about guns, and you were trying to get him to explain, well, who would you be shooting? And he never quite explained himself.
Right.
And the first thing I wanted to say is, I don't know if you've ever looked at it from this standpoint, but it looks like some of these people who like to stockpile guns, I wonder if it's sort of a male version of the hoarding mentality that sometimes women get when they get older, where they start to hoard, you know, dolls and things, and their house becomes full of junk.
Could be.
And I wonder if, you know, because men are socialized to like guns, if they sort of hoard them for some sort of psychological reason.
Could be. And there's the whole, you know, Freud's, you know, take on that, too.
Yeah, I've heard that one before, too. But the other comment I had that was a little more serious was, and this is something I've been concerned about as well, and maybe this is what that gentleman was getting at, but he never explained. Maybe some people are concerned that if there's a collapse of the economy, because nowadays people have less connection to each other and have more violent media that they're exposed to, that folks might panic and take to the street and start to rob and rampage. And some folks think, oh, well, if I go into my house and I have a gun, I'll be able to keep my neighbors that have gone crazy from taking my food.
Yeah. Well, I think that is the image of the future that these people are creating for themselves. And as one of the callers earlier, who apparently from the way he was talking has more than just a passing familiarity with psychology, said, you know, this is an anxiety disorder. We're causing a panic disorder. And, or not we, but I mean, you know, this kind of rhetoric and this kind of worldview is causing people to imagine a dystopian future, a Blade Runner future that in all probability will not exist, and then take the feelings of that future and bring them into the present moment and freak out.
That's true, and I think that might have actually influenced the George Zimmerman case, where in his mind he automatically assumed somebody walking at night in my neighborhood who I am personally not familiar with must be a burglar out to do evil,
right,
rather than thinking, oh, it's some kid that went to the store or somebody that's lost or something.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't disagree. And this we're now experiencing a national psychosis in this area. Excellent point, Suzanne. Thank you for calling and making it. Mo in Chicago. Hey, Mo, what's up?
I think that in psychoanalyzing, those of us who see disasters coming, you're doing the same thing to us that the establishment with Joe McCarthy as the point man did to the liberals and progressives in the 50s, in the 40s and the 50s. They were saying because the communists who were out to get us are some kind of socialist, then, or some kind of left-winger, all left-wingers are suspect. I want to recommend to you and your listeners a book that offers very scholarly and technical analysis of all the catastrophes that have already begun with the increased power of hurricanes, with increased flooding, increased drought, and we may help it along by destroying the Ogallala
aquifer
water table. And the book I recommend is The Upside of Down. Have you heard of it?
No, I'm writing it down, though.
Yeah, oh, good, thank you. And it's by Thomas Homer Dixon. The last name is hyphenated, Homer hyphen D-I-X-O-N.
Okay.
He's a Canadian economist, but he's got about 80 pages of footnotes from geologists, climatologists, political historians, sociologists, anthropologists. The book is totally amazing, and you'll probably thank me for having recommended it. And actually, there's another book also by a Canadian called Climate Wars.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah. So, sure, there are some crazy people. There are crazy people who believe that the sun is going to rise tomorrow morning. That doesn't mean that it won't.
Yeah. I get your point, Mo, and in fact, I am of the opinion that if we don't do something about global warming with some speed, that we might be looking at the extinction of more than 90% of all life on Earth. I also believe that, and I think with some good evidence, that the economic policies that we continue to pursue, left over from the Reagan era, are going to cause us to crash into another Great Depression. But what differentiates me and those beliefs from Mr. Shea, Matt Shea, the Tea Party guy who is the head of the assistant Republican floor leader for the House of Representatives in the state of Washington, what distinguishes me from him, for what it's worth, is that he's saying because of these things or other things, maybe in his mind it's like, you know, too many brown people coming in from Mexico or something. I mean, that's probably Pat Buchanan's big fear. Whatever. Because of these things, therefore we have to get guns. And therefore we have to arm up. And I'm saying, yes, there's a lot of potentially bad stuff in our future. There's a lot of potentially really good stuff in our future. We've got some incredible, you know, new energy technologies. There is so much that we could be doing right. But I'm working to try to avoid the bad stuff and make the good stuff happen rather than saying, okay, you know, I'm going to hit the internet and buy, you know, five AR-15s and 3,000 rounds of ammunition.
Well, you'll enjoy parts of this book because the title, after all, is The Upside of Down. He is telling us how we can confront these disasters. If we can't prevent them, how we can adapt.
Interesting. Okay. Mo, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Where despair is not an option, let me add, you can take that concern and turn it into action. We got to do something about this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop by our free live chat room over at tomhartman.com. It's great fun. The bad and the very, very macro, summaciously ugly, the good. Representative Justin Amash, a Republican, second-term Republican congressman, has made a name for himself in Washington as a fierce champion of civil liberties. On Sunday, he showed once again why he got that reputation when he defended Edward Snowden as a whistleblower during an appearance on Fox News Sunday. Check it out.
So you can still consider him a whistleblower?
Yes.
Because...
Well, he can...
I mean, he had signed an oath, he had said he wasn't going to give up these secrets, and he gave up the secrets.
Yeah. As I said, he may be doing things overseas that we would find problematic, that we would find dangerous. We'll find those facts out over time. But as far as Congress is concerned, sure, he's a whistleblower. He told us what we needed to know.
Congressman Amash is spot on. Let's just hope the rest of the Washington establishment is listening. The bad. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Employees at a Kenosha, Wisconsin animal shelter got quite a shock earlier this month when Department of National Resources agents burst into their barn, grabbed a baby deer, and shot it. Here's what shelter employee Ray Schultz told WISN Wisconsin about the incident.
I was thinking in my mind, well, yeah, they're going to take the deer and take it to a wildlife shelter. And then here they come carrying the baby deer over their shoulder like a bag of, she was in a body bag. I said, why did you do that? He said, well, it's our policy. And I said, well, that's one hell of a policy.
Just lovely. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources uses SWAT teams to kill Bambi. How's that for public service? And the very, very ugly Ted Nugent. The rock star turned right-wing pundit has been on a nonstop controversy tour ever since George Zimmerman was found not guilty of murdering Trayvon Martin in July. And during an interview this weekend, he outdid himself, saying that Martin was a gangsta wannabe who got justice. There you have it, people. In Ted Nugent's America, justice is armed white men hunting down random black kids they think look like criminals. It's just unbelievably racist and unbelievably very, very ugly. Mind-bogglingly ugly. Adam, in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Adam, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak with you. I wanted to bring up the McConnell race in Kentucky. He's got this lady, and I'm not even sure of her name.
Allison Lundergan Grimes.
Grimes, yes. And I think that what we need to do as Democrats is we need to impose the strategy that the Tea Party used in 2009. You might remember 4 years ago this month is when you had all these crazy people in those tea, you know, in the triangle hats and all that, you know, in, screaming at these town halls and making all this noise. And I contend that the Democrats need to bring on a similar strategy for 2014. And I think that Grimes race is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if she'll win it, but they'll have to put resources in it, which will free up Colorado. We have Udall coming for re-election. I don't know what Tea Party kook they're going to run. Probably this guy from the Loveland area here in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wondered what your strategy is for 2014, because this is going to be critical going into 2016. And I do think Hillary is the candidate, by the way.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you that Hillary will, in all probability, be the candidate. You know, assuming that nothing radical changes in her life or the country's life over the next few years. As for Allison Lundergan Grimes, I think that she's a great candidate. She's I believe she's the attorney general of the state right now, and she's running to be governor. She's a Democrat. She's got a good political history. She's a take names and kick butt type, you know, real solid person. I mean, you know, she's just a politician. And I think she's going to give Mitch McConnell a run for his money. She already is. I mean, you know, he's either losing to her or beating her by just 1 point, depending on which poll you're looking at right now. And she has very little name recognition compared to him.
And
I think
Tom, don't you think that means they'll have to put money into that race to defend it more than they otherwise would have?
They already are.
Which frees up, you know, the deep. I'm telling you, and we have Bennett. He's the chairman of the Democratic senatorial campaign. You might know our Senator Bennett.
Mm.
And you better watch out, Republicans. Don't think that you're just going to sweep, you know, just because it's an off-year election.
Yeah.
Don't forget 1998.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing that I think can't be replicated from the election from the election of 2008 and to some extent 2010 that the Tea Party did. The Tea Partiers, you know, they got out there and with enough money from the Koch brothers and a few other cranky billionaires. And, you know, laundering it through Dick Armey's Freedom Works and a few of these other organizations. They convinced and trained people to be passionate. You know, Obamacare is going to destroy the country. It's going to socialize medicine. It's going to be the end of America, all this kind of stuff. And they got these people so worked up that when Democrats came home to their districts to hold town hall meetings, the crazies showed up and just freaked out. And so the Republican strategy since then has been pretty much not to hold town hall meetings. I mean, you've got a lot of members of Congress, particularly Republicans, who just don't do that anymore. They just don't.
Well,
they don't have contact.
And in Colorado here, Tom, you might take note that Congressman Kaufman, Mike Kaufman, he's running commercials this month. You know, ballyhoo and his immigration stance, and he's for everyone. Mm-hmm. I think they're very worried about that seat in Colorado, and I'd suggest that you pay attention to it.
Is he a Democrat or a Republican?
He's a Republican, and he was redistricted about a year or two ago, I believe, and he's actually, his district encompasses Aurora, where the theater shooting is.
Right.
So, you know, there's just a lot of emotion there, and I think that he's defending a seat that, you know, he may have to defend it a lot harder than he thinks.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think with Grimes, this lady in Kentucky, and a few other races, you know, they're going to bring out all this, these people who, you know, that, what was it, the rape, the legitimate rape, and all those kind of people.
Yeah, the Todd Akins.
I think
you're right, Ed. I think that there's a very real possibility that the Democrats can take the House back in 2014 and keep control of the Senate, and they can take the White House in 2016. And if they have a strong candidate there, and if the economy is bad enough that they get a good, strong majority, that they can keep the Republicans from blaming Obama for the economy that the Republicans have created, then I think that, you know, things might work out. We'll see, but we all need to be working toward it. I'm with you. Jeff in North Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to chime in about the earlier conversation you had about the carbon tax and
yes.
carbon pollution and energy and so forth. One thing that really, I guess, saddens me is the stupidity of the human race letting the all the solar energy that falls upon the Sahara Desert go to waste. Right now in the labs, the best solar cell efficiencies are around 30%. Right now available in the market, the best solar cell efficiencies are 30%. In the lab right now, our solar cell efficiencies that approach 70%. They're the multi-wavelength solar cells mm-hmm. that should be available within 10 years, and that will change everything.
Yeah.
But the most foolish thing that man can do is let all that solar energy that's falling on the Sahara Desert go to waste. If that was utilized, all this debate about carbon pollution, CO2, and global warming would be a moot point because all
yeah.
that solar energy would be utilized.
And it's not just the Sahara Desert. I mean, we've got the Mojave Desert if you're looking for deserts. But beyond that, if we simply did what Germany does, Germany is the cloudiest country in Europe. And they did this program to put solar panels on the rooftops of houses, and they've replaced 10 nuclear reactors now, or created an amount of electricity equal to the output of 10 nuclear reactors, just by putting solar panels on people's roofs. And they did it without any expenditure of government government funds. They did it by giving a tax incentive to people to put these things in their house by forcing the power companies to buy the electricity back at a more expensive rate that only reflected the cost of building a nuclear power plant that they weren't going to have to build. So it was an investment the power companies were going to make anyway, and backstopping the banks to make 2% low interest loans over a 10-year period for people to pay for these solar installations that have a 50-year lifespan. So yeah, it can be done. I'm totally with you, Jeff. Thank you for the call. Vincent in Amherst, Mass. Hey, Vincent, got a minute to the break. It's yours.
Well, and with regard to your talk radio news service discussion about these things that are appearing about the imminent attacks or something like
mm-hmm.
that from the Al-Qaeda notices, I mean, there are two other possible explanations. One is that the Al-Qaeda network is testing the U.S. reactions to postings.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, the second possibility is that the U.S. is making false postings and seeing what their Al-Qaeda network's reaction to those false postings are.
Which would be much more dangerous.
Right. But since we can close our embassies and so forth, presumably they wouldn't be doing that. But certainly the Al-Qaeda network could be making postings to test our reaction.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. And as Victoria said, it could just be a coincidence that this happens at a time that the administration is desperate to change the conversation away from Ed Snowden and on to, hey, gee, we really need and love the NSA. Vincent, thank you for the call and the proposals. We'll be right back 15 minutes before the
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And keep track of this story Reuters was carrying about the DEA having their own spy agency, the Drug Enforcement Administration of America. 10 minutes before the hour, Brian in Rogers, Minnesota, listening on KTNF. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I enjoy listening to your show. You do a great job. I appreciate all the things that you have to say and your opinions on a great number of things.
But
before I get to the point I need to ask a favor of you.
Sure.
Can you please stop referring to that criminally insane, psychotic Ted Nugent as a right-wing pundit? I don't think you're doing anybody any good by giving him credence to what he says.
Well, that's, he's
far from being a pundit.
Okay, all right.
I can't
guarantee that I'll stop.
Rambling
but,
on.
You know, the guy goes on Fox all the time. I mean, that's the kind of the definition of a pundit is somebody who pops up in the media.
Yeah, he's just, he doesn't.
Maybe you should take it up with Fox.
No. The only people I want to talk to less than Ted Nugent are the people over at Fox.
Okay. So Brian, you wanted to talk about collecting guns?
I did. I was listening to the lady earlier, maybe about a half hour or so ago,
And
she was saying that she doesn't understand why people collect guns. She doesn't. She thought, you know, maybe it's a type of hoarding or whatever. I enjoy shooting sports, mm-hmm. crap shooting, skeet shooting, so on and so forth.
So do I.
Hunting and whatnot.
I don't hunt, but I shoot. Yeah.
Sure. But,
but I'm guessing you don't own 100 guns.
What's that?
I'm guessing you don't own 100 guns.
No, I don't own 100 guns. But I'm not fearful that the government is going to come trampling in on my home or whatever. But I have a fair amount of guns.
Mm-hmm.
And my father has guns. It's our family, my family enjoys the shooting sports,
sure.
right?
Sure.
For some people, it's, you know, when you go over to somebody's house and they've got the rack of 50 spoons or shot glasses or whatever, some people collect guns like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't make them insane. It doesn't make them wrong.
I agree. I agree. And I shouldn't have been so glib as to say, yes, that's the same thing as hoarding. What I was thinking of is that very small percentage, and I saw the statistic about 5 or 6 months ago. I'm sorry, I can't quote the exact details off the top of my head. But there is a very small percentage of gun owners who are radically skewing the per capita gun ownership numbers in the United States, the general statistics. Because, first of all, when you consider, you know, six out of 10 Americans don't own a gun, right? Three out of, what would that be? In any case, 6 out of 10 Americans don't own a gun. 3 out of 5. And the remaining people who do own guns typically own 1, 2, or 3 guns, something like that. But there's this very small slice of people who literally own dozens to hundreds of guns. And those were the hoarders that I was thinking of. And I'm guessing you're not one of them. But David Koresh certainly was.
Right. David Koresh was. I've probably got close to a dozen shotguns and rifles and things.
Yeah,
like that.
My brother has, six or eight guns. I mean, I don't think that there's anything weird about that.
Okay.
Well, what's weird is when people start, you know, combining that with a basement full of food and, you know, 50,000 rounds of ammunition and start talking about the end days. I mean, that's when it starts getting weird to me.
And it gets that weird to me. And unfortunately, you know, when I go to travel to different, you know, camps and hunting areas and things like that, you run into those people. And
you do. I have in Michigan on many occasions. And so it's not just, I mean, it may be a lunatic fringe, but it's not the tiniest fringe. It's not as a tiny fringe as it should be. So, Brian, thank you for the call. Thanks for clarifying all that stuff. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank. Libertarians?
Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
This is about something I saw.
Frank? Frank, I think I think your phone croaked on you. Gilbert in Clearfield, Utah. Hey, Gilbert.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me here. Hey, I'm up, but I hope you can hear me well. But I just wanted to first of all comment on the Ray, I think his name was, the one you awarded the book to. How he mentioned how Hannity, Limbaugh, those guys really manipulate a lot of their.
He wasn't naming names, but he was. Yeah, okay.
Well, anyhow, I actually think he did say Limbaugh and Hannity, but nevertheless, I follow politics a lot, maybe too much, but listening to those guys, I mean, to me, it's obvious what they're trying to do, and I just can't see how anybody can see it, or can't see it. But I did also want to talk about our chances in 2014 of taking the House. Like I said, I follow politics. I hear some people saying we don't have a chance, and some hear some people we do. And so I want to get your take on what do you really think is going to, what our chances are in 2014? And by the way, that meeting that happened when Obama was elected, how come that doesn't get more national attention than what the Republicans are
trying? It wasn't even publicly revealed until about 2 years ago when Robert Draper published his book, and he was the first to report on it. Since then, it's popped up in 3 or 4 other books. But basically, the Republicans who were there, I mean, there wasn't a waiter who videotaped it like happened with Romney. And the Republicans who were there kept their mouths shut, or when they did talk about it, they only talked inside Republican circles. And, I think, frankly, it really wasn't totally confirmed until I asked Newt Gingrich about it on the air. And he not only said yes, but he bragged about it. He was like, yeah, you know, we're the opposition. We've got to organize ourselves to take down the other guy. My phrase, not his. And, you know, I totally understand that from a partisan point of view, that it's really important to do that, you know, to be the loyal opposition. But I think that you should do it in a way that doesn't harm the people of the republic in the process, and doesn't harm the democratic institutions in the process, and doesn't destroy the economy. So anyhow, yeah, right. that's my take on it. Gilbert, we're out of time here. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening on Sirius there in Gilbert. Coming up tomorrow, the president's going to be giving a speech on housing in Phoenix, Arizona, and the right-wingers are already grumbling about it.
What? How dare he give a speech? The president? He's not supposed to do that.
I'll challenge conservative Tanya Marchol of Team Investments. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you, okay? You're it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.